More potentially damaging disclosures today in London for top News Corp executive James Murdoch. He had been favored to take over the media conglomerate run by his father, Rupert Murdoch, until a tabloid phone hacking scandal erupted over the summer. James Murdoch has overseen the company's British operations since late 2007, but he testified that he was not aware of the widespread nature of phone hacking at its tabloid News of the World until last year. Well, now attorneys for News Corp's UK division have revealed emails showing British executives at the company tried to inform the younger Murdoch back in June 2008 of damaging hacking allegations. NPR's David Folkenflik has been following this story. And David, tell us why that date is so crucial now, June 2008.
Well, June 2008, Colin Myler, the editor of the News in the World tabloid, sent a note to his boss, James Murdoch, say, hey, can I get 5 minutes of your time on Tuesday, 3 days later? The reason that's important is that that Tuesday meeting, a fairly short one, led to a confidential and, for that time, unprecedented private settlement equivalent to about $1 million. In which News Corp's British divisions paid off the head of the Professional Footballers Association for claims that News of the World had hacked into his mobile phone. That was a key moment. It was at a time when News of the World had basically said that an earlier hacking incident involved the Royals had been an isolated case involving a rogue reporter and rogue private investigator for the tabloid.
And a lot of the question here really is what did James Murdoch know and when did he know it? What is the implication of that email then?
Well, the email would suggest a couple of things. It would contradict the rogue reporter. I'm looking at a copy of the email in my hands. It says, James, unfortunately, it is as bad as we feared. Mm. And he draws attention to the note from Julian Pike, who had been an attorney for News Corp in the UK. And these were emails below that had been attached on this this exchange, in which they were saying, look, there's nightmare scenario possible. There are some earlier incidents that may be problematic for us that should be looked at. James Murdoch himself says the defense, look, this was sent to me on a Saturday. I read it on my BlackBerry. I responded within 2 or 3 minutes. The timestamps show that to be the case. And I never really looked beyond the original request by Colin Myler. He was the guy who should have been briefing me on all this.
What do you think the effect of this is on James Murdoch and on the testimony that he gave earlier?
I think it is an extremely damaging moment for James Murdoch. He has testified repeatedly to Parliament that this was the work of a rogue reporter. He has said this year on a number of occasions he didn't really understand the magnitude until, as you mentioned, last year with the lawsuit from the actress Sienna Miller saying her phone voicemail messages had been hacked into by the tabloid. It now appears as though there was every effort by the executives below him to inform him, to let him understand that the threat to News of the World was significant and to News Corp in the UK.
And David, I gather that the police investigation into the hacking that started this whole scandal has also yielded some new information. What's going on there?
That's right. The disclosure in July that the voicemails of a young girl who was abducted and it turned out killed nearly a decade ago really triggered an outcry. Her emails had been hacked into, listened to, and deleted, the police said then. They now say they can't prove, they aren't certain that it was done by somebody acting on behalf of the tabloid. People linked to the News of the World, which was closed down amidst this scandal, have said, look, this shows that The Guardian, which has been leading the reporting on this, has been deeply unfair. But in fact, the core elements of this have held up and shown to be true. In fact, Millie Dowler and many hundreds of others were hacked into, their voicemails listened to, and in fact, their privacy invaded.
Okay. NPR's David Folkenflik in New York. David, thank you.
You bet.
From oil now to the driver's seat, commentator Andrei Kudrescu has been paying attention to the latest in automotive trends, and he sent us this poem about our love affair with the car. One word of warning, you might want to fasten your seatbelt.
They are advertising a car on TV. It's a computer. The GPS will get you to work and back in case you forgot how to get there. It will even tell you why you work there in case you're philosophically anxious. And if you're hungover from the night before, it'll go to work for you, because it's GPS Plus, the metamorphic version. The car will also park itself, in case you forgot your parking permit or don't have any quarters. Who has quarters these days, anyway? And if there is no place to park, the car will squeeze itself between other cars, thinning out like a slice of ham, and it will even spew out quarters if you need them. The music system sounds like you're right at the concert, and the video puts you in front, right next to the band. And if you see somebody you like, the car will pick them up for you and make itself into a sexy condo where you can listen to your different musics while doing whatever you do, tweeting and Facebooking it simultaneously, so you can watch it in instant replay while still on your way to work. All this will cost you nothing for 2 years, except 1 inch of body height every month, and you'll be all paid up by the time you're the size of a slice of ham. And you won't need anything then, because you'll be the car. You've been tagged. And the next buyer will be happy to be taken to work in your 3D plasma body with GPS++. Society will benefit from this too, because if people who buy this car now become their cars in the future, there will be less people and more cars. And that, said Mr. Ford, is how smoothly society should function.
Those thoughts from Andrei Kadrescu, the author of the book Whatever Gets You Through the Night, A Story of Scheherazade and the Arabian Entertainments.
You know, as we approach Christmas, we've been learning on this program about holiday food traditions, and today, a southern Italian tradition, La Cena della Vigilia di Natale, or dinner on Christmas Eve. That evening, the meal for many Italians is the Feast of the Seven Fishes. It's a tradition many Italian Americans have adopted, or adapted, as Catherine Perry reports.
Cindy Coddington, who grew up with the feast, remembers the day as a whirlwind of family and fry pans.
Ours was fried shrimp, fried scallops, pan-fried smelts, calamari cut up in rings and fried. And after the holiday, you really couldn't stand the sight of any more fried food for a while.
Cindy says that while the food didn't look like her friend's Norman Rockwell spreads, everything else that went with the feast said classic Christmas. Except her family's idea of a Christmas carol was a little different.
Do you know the song, Volare with Domenico Modugno? Oh, Lare. Oh, cantare, oh, that song played in the background.
Volare, oh, cantare, oh.
It was very exciting. You know, all of your relatives were coming over and your mom was cooking all day. This went on for several hours. We'd stay up until midnight. And that's when presents were exchanged, at midnight. And that became Christmas.
But today, most people don't have the time to cook the feast, or enough extended family to eat it. And that's where restaurants come in. At Island Creek Oyster Bar in Boston, Chef Jeremy Sewell is doing his own version, featuring items like Jonah Crab beignets and tuna crudo. It is not your grandmother's feast. But Sewell says he's not trying to co-opt tradition. He's trying to keep it alive.
I think it's fun to bring it into the restaurant sometimes, but I think preserving the home kind of tradition is as important as well.
And Cindy Coddington agrees. She likes to see a creative take on the feast, but she'd still like to see it come back home someday. Every year, she still gives a nod to it in her house by serving at least one fish on Christmas Eve. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Perry.
With traditional public schools, where a family lives determines where a child will go to school. Charter schools were supposed to give people a choice, but that choice isn't always an option for some students with disabilities. That's the finding of an investigation by the NPR State Impact Florida Project and the Miami Herald. Reporter Sarah Gonzalez has more.
Like a lot of 17-year-old boys, high school for Trace Whitlock isn't just about what happens in the classroom. It's also about girls.
Do you have a crush?
Trace has cerebral palsy. He can't walk or speak. But like any embarrassed teenager, he laughs.
Does she go to your school?
Trace communicates by typing on a computer that generates a voice to tell us his future career.
A game programmer.
Right now, he's creating an iPod app so kids with disabilities can decorate and race virtual wheelchairs. Trace is a computer whiz. So when a charter school opened up near Tampa with an emphasis on computers, Trace had to apply. But when his family went for a tour of Pivot Charter School, Trace says the principal told him, "You can't come here."
Do you know why? What they told you?
I can't go to the bathroom by myself.
Tanya Whitlock is Trace's mom. She says that's not fair.
The medications that Trace is on, he doesn't go to the bathroom very often. But if he has to go, there needs to be somebody there. And that was our only request that we did ask for. It's like we're begging people to just please let him go to your school.
They've been fighting to get him into Pivot Charter School for the past 5 months. The school's principal is Carmela David. She wouldn't talk about Trace specifically or agree to be recorded. She says her school does serve some students with disabilities, but records show that no students with Trace's level of needs go to Pivot. And that's typical for most Florida charter schools. State Impact Florida and the Miami Herald analyzed enrollment data on kids with severe disabilities, like Trace, kids with cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and autism. Our investigation found that more than 85% of Florida charter schools don't have a single student with a severe disability. That's compared to half of traditional public schools. Take Jacksonville, Florida. There are more than 1,000 students in that district with a severe disability. One attends a charter school. Other counties don't have any such students.
If we had similar patterns of exclusion of kids by gender or race, I think there would be much more outrage than there is.
That's Thomas Hare. Back in the Clinton administration, he was the top official in charge of special education, and he helped rewrite federal disability law.
I think that there is a disincentive to enroll these kids because they do cost more money to educate.
For instance, Miami-Dade is Florida's largest school district, and state funding only covers about 60% the cost of educating a severely disabled student. State and federal laws say no school, traditional or charter, is allowed to turn away kids because it's too expensive to educate them. But there's a loophole. The law also says students with severe disabilities can only go to schools that provide the services they need. And our investigation found that most Florida charter schools do not offer those services. Adam Miller oversees charter schools at the Florida Department of Education. He says the traditional public school system has had decades to coordinate their programs and share special ed teachers. But charter schools haven't gotten there yet because each charter school operates on its own.
It would be challenging for a single school to set up a program for a single student, which I think is why you see that, for the most part, that doesn't happen.
It didn't happen for Belkis Vigil and her son David in Miami. He's 7 and has autism. Vigil says she tried to enroll David in several Miami charter schools because students are supposed to get one-on-one attention. But she says they all told her the same thing.
Oh, we don't take them. Oh, we don't have the facilities for a special needs child. Nobody. The tears that I would cry because of the rejection, it was constant.
Now David is going to a private school, and his parents have to pay thousands of dollars a year. And remember Trace, the teenager with cerebral palsy? He's now going to a traditional public school that has a program for kids with autism. And his mom says he doesn't even have autism.
We had to compromise. We had to settle with an environment that we knew wasn't absolutely the best for him because we didn't have any other choices.
Trace says he desperately wants to be with regular kids.
I want to prove to them that I can be in normal classes.
And the girl Trace has a crush on, she's in one of those normal classes, but he's off in a different part of the school, so he's never had the chance to tell her how he feels. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Gonzalez in Miami.
Reporter John O'Connor, also with the project State Impact Florida, contributed to that report. Let's go now from new technology to a classic brand trying to stay relevant. The American photography pioneer Kodak is also struggling just to survive. The company is being dogged by bankruptcy rumors. Its stock has tumbled to less than a dollar. Kodak is still sounding optimistic, at least in public. It expects strong fourth quarter earnings. Zach Seward from the Innovation Trail Reporting Project in upstate New York sent us this story from Kodak's hometown of Rochester.
Linda now is like a lot of native Rochesterians.
I grew up in a Kodak family. Aunts, uncles, father, brother-in-law.
Now herself even worked at Kodak. As a college kid in the late 60s, Now was paid $10 an hour for a summer job making sure film canisters didn't let in light. But now, more than 40 years later, she's in a Rochester area Best Buy, helping her husband pick out a new camera, and Kodak is not part of the conversation.
Unfortunately, no.
Why?
I don't think the quality of the Kodak cameras are as good as they used to be.
During holiday shopping season on Kodak's home turf, you might assume this is troubling news for the imaging giant, but according to Kodak, you'd be wrong.
We expect a very, very good fourth quarter.
That's Kodak CEO Antonio Perez. Kodak wouldn't talk to us on tape for this story, but Perez spoke on the company's investor conference call last month, saying that things are looking up.
All four of our digital growth businesses will expand in the fourth quarter.
But none of those are camera businesses. Kodak even recently sold off its image sensor division, reportedly for a couple $100 million. Kodak has long been in the process of a painful transformation that's seen tens of thousands of Kodak workers in the Rochester area lose their jobs. But when Perez talks about the company's digital transformation and the new Kodak, he's talking about four growth businesses in particular, three of which serve the commercial printing industry.
They will be the nucleus of the new Kodak.
In short, Kodak is becoming a company that makes high-end printing equipment, not a consumer staple whose brand once rivaled Coca-Cola's in global ubiquity.
That's fading away by design.
Mark Kaufman is an analyst who follows Kodak for Rafferty Capital Markets. He's seen the company's stock plummet in the last year, driven by investor fears that Kodak is on its last legs. A recent move to tap a revolving credit line, the shuffling of key legal advisors, and higher-than-expected losses have sunk Kodak shares to under a dollar. But Kaufman says there is some reason for optimism.
This is an important quarter because, well, they've actually started to make some inroads in getting the cash on the balance sheet.
Kaufman expects Kodak to finish up the year in relatively decent shape. An upcoming patent sale could net the company billions. Several of Kodak's massive $3 million printing presses are coming online in Asia, and once they're up and running, they run exclusively on Kodak inks and printheads. Kaufman even says a seasonal surge in movie film and catalog printing creates an inflow of cash.
If you really think about it, who the end users are, they're more businesses than individual consumers.
But that's the one you recommend, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
which brings us back to Linda Now at the Rochester area Best Buy. Of the four pillars of the new Kodak, only one, desktop inkjet printing, is consumer-oriented. While Kodak digital cameras have been relegated to the Best Buy website because of poor sales, you can get a Kodak printer at the store, but Now isn't buying. She already has a printer made by Canon, but when she prints out photos at home, she does use Kodak paper.
I try to keep some loyalty there.
For NPR News, I'm Zach Seward in Rochester, New York.